Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta filling in on this Wednesday, October 9th. Currently sitting around 30 degrees in the Wasatch Back. Sunny skies. The smoke has cleared out a little bit, still hanging around. But on the phone with me to talk more about weather, I've got ABC4 meteorologist Nate Larson. How's it going, Nate?
Good, Parker. Hey, good morning, Wasatch Back, Park City area. Yeah, we do have still, of course, smoke impacts from the Yellow Lake fire burning in the western Uintas. Air quality just checked. Wasatch County looking pretty good as far as the current reading, but yellow, if not moderate. Air quality expected to continue for much of Wasatch, Duchesne, Carbon, and even Uinta counties today. So some hazy skies, sunshine otherwise. Temperatures climbing back to well above average, mid-70s again for today. So the above average temperatures, thanks to high pressure that's situated to the south of us, keeping us on the dry side, and a south warm flow in place as well. About 81 in Heber with some of those smoky skies as well. Overnight lows, forecasting still shows in the 40s, about 48, 49 for overnight lows, mid-70s again for highs tomorrow, depending on elevation. Partly cloudy skies. We'll just see some high clouds move in as a weak front passes to the north of us. It doesn't really impact our temperatures, though. We're going to stick with mid to low 70s all the way through the end of the week and the weekend. We're still tracking a little bit of moisture. Timing on it still a little bit up in the air. As we get closer, we should be able to hammer out more of the details, but partly cloudy skies on Sunday. There's a slight chance, only a 10% chance of maybe an isolated shower or two. Temperatures falling into the upper 60s by Tuesday next week for Park City, with overnight lows still in the mid to low 40s. Heber looking at, again, smoke impacts as long as that Yellow Lake fire continues to burn. Low 80s expected through the end of the week, upper 70s over the weekend with partly cloudy skies. Still a 10% chance Sunday, Monday next week of a stray shower, and temperatures falling into the mid 70s by Tuesday next week. Overnight lows in the mid 30s into next week as well.
All right. Sounds good, Nate. Thanks for it. Have a good one.
Thank you. Yep, you too.
Just had a crash report come through on the UDOT website looking just east of Kimball Junction on westbound I-80 at mile point 146, so approaching the Highway 40 flyover intersection there. The right shoulder is closed on westbound I-80. The estimated clearance time is 9:15. But if you're heading on westbound I-80 between Highway 40 and Kimball Junction, do expect delays. That crash was just reported only a few minutes ago at the top of the hour. Well, coming up, Red Cross of Utah Greater Salt Lake Chapter Director Jeremiah LaFranca will join the show to talk about National Fire Prevention Week and how to prevent house fires. Then Park City Manager Matt Dias will be in studio to preview tomorrow's City Council meeting. Getting into some news now, both Summit and Wasatch counties are projected to see significant population growth ahead of the 2034 Winter Olympics, according to a new report from the University of Utah. The Kempsey-Gardner Policy Institute released new short-term planning projections Tuesday, detailing how experts expect Utah's population and economy to change over the coming decade. The population in Wasatch County is expected to grow 22% by 2033, second only to Tooele County, where the projected rate of growth is 24%. Summit County's population is projected to increase by 10%, the same rate as Salt Lake County. Researchers expect Wasatch County's population to come close to surpassing Summit County ahead of the Olympics. Both are expected to hover around 48,000 residents in 2033. The number of households is projected to follow a similar trend. The report says households in Wasatch County will grow by 32% over the next decade, with roughly 19% growth in Summit County. Both counties are projected to have around 17,000 households in 2033. The new report also shows strong economic indicators for the Wasatch Back. Jobs in Summit and Wasatch counties are estimated to grow by 15% over the next decade, which ranks in the top five counties for projected job growth across the state. From a statewide perspective, Utah's population is expected to increase from 3.5 million to 4 million residents by 2033, driven by both natural increase and net migration. The state's economy is projected to add 330,000 jobs in that time frame, a 13% increase. Researchers expect high-growth industries to include professional and technical services, healthcare, construction, and finance. You can find that full report at kpcw.org. It's 8:13 now. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. On the phone with me now, I've got Jeremiah LaFranca. He's the Red Cross of Utah Greater Salt Lake Chapter Director. How's it going this morning?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm great. Well, we're here to talk about National Fire Prevention Week that's going on this week. You know, I guess just to start with just a general overview, you know, what awareness are you trying to bring, you know, to residents and people this week?
Yeah, so this is the 102nd Fire Prevention Week. It's something that was created in honor of and to commemorate the Great Chicago Fire, which began on October 8, 1871. Mm-hmm. It caused a devastating loss of life and property. And so since 1925, this has been nationally recognized under presidential proclamation just to highlight the need to have working smoke alarms, to think about home fire safety, having home fire escape plans, things of that nature.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about fire prevention, you know, what are kind of the most common things that you guys try to get out there or see as people maybe not meeting in terms of the requirements?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem that we see is working smoke alarms. Oftentimes people hear the chirping going on in the background, right? I think we've all experienced that. People get annoyed by that. They'll take the smoke alarms out, and then they don't put them back in, or they just don't change the batteries and let it die. That creates a difficult situation. You know, more than 60% of home fire deaths are related to homes that don't have working smoke alarms. So that's the number one thing that we recommend for people, and that's something that we actually help with. We go into people's homes, we'll actually install up to 3 free smoke alarms. So there should be no barriers for anyone to have working smoke alarms in their home.
Yeah, and if, you know, a family wants to get together and form, you know, some kind of escape plan for, you know, a situation where a fire were to erupt, you know, what are the main components you think are important that they try to include?
I think the main thing is make sure that you kind of draw that out, right? Have each room identified, make sure there are escape routes, at least 2 per room. Look and make sure that you mark smoke alarms in that plan with an S. With a circle around it, and then there should, looking at it, you should see at least 1 smoke alarm in every bedroom or sleeping area. That's another item that a lot of people won't think about, is that you need to be alerted, especially when sleeping is occurring. You know, if you've got small kids, especially, that can be something that's scary that's happening in the middle of the night, so making sure they're aware of how those work. So you're including that in your plan to make sure everybody knows what to do in those situations. Practice the plan. Make sure you have somewhere that you're going to meet outside of the home, usually a neighbor's house or somewhere that's close by where everybody can get to.
Yeah, and you know, and obviously we're entering the winter season. Things are starting to cool down a little bit, and the heaters start to get brought out and whatnot. Are there any specific devices you think, you know, that comes around during the winter time that, you know, people should be especially aware of because they could spark a blaze?
Yeah, definitely space heaters. That is one of the number one things that we see during winter time. People don't think about that. When they have the space heaters on, they'll leave them on. And then suddenly, you know, there's a problem because they left the room and they come back and find that there's a fire that started. Candles also, I think a lot of people start, you know, getting the fall candles out and everything else. They place them too close to like flammable curtains, tablecloths, and other materials. And then lastly, you know, again, not necessarily associated with the cold, but, you know, everybody starts doing Christmas trees in December. So when you get dried out Christmas trees, those go up within a matter of seconds. And that will start to spread quickly. With our furniture these days, one thing that people don't notice too much of is that there's a lot of synthetic materials. So those are actually just really, it's fuel for a fire, and it goes up quickly that way.
Yeah. You know, I did want to just zoom out in general. If you could just talk about, you know, specifically the Red Cross, but your branch in Salt Lake, you know, what is kind of your role? And, you know, I assume you guys have a very broad portfolio and things in terms you're involved in, but why involved in National Fire Prevention Week?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director in Salt Lake. My focus is on overall public relations. We deal with, obviously, everything from home fires to hurricane response, right, mm-hmm. that we see that's ongoing right now. As well as blood collection. The reason that we focus on Home Fire Protection Week is, you know, thinking about the impact that has on families. It's actually the number one disaster we respond to every year. You know, everybody thinks about the Red Cross and disasters. They think hurricanes, tornadoes. about 60% of what we respond to every year are home fires. And so when a home fire occurs, we're out there supporting a family. We'll give them some immediate assistance. We make sure that we find them a place to stay. We try to make sure that they have any medications that they lost in the fire recovered. We also look at making sure that we connect them with partners and open up the case to make sure that they're on the road to recovery. So for us, this is about humanitarian work. And that's why home fires has kind of got a close place in our hearts, just to make sure that we're assisting people in those times of need. But also the smoke alarms came about because, you know, we have some generous donors that assist us. And really, we want to make sure that we prevent the disaster from occurring. People have 2 minutes to get out of a home fire. So we want to make sure that we prevent, you know, the worst from occurring as best as we can.
Yeah, and I did want to mention that program. If I have the information right, it's looking like the website is soundthealarm.org/Utah, and their residents can schedule an appointment for a free smoke alarm and installation. Can you just talk a bit more again about that?
Yeah, if you go to that website, again, at soundthealarm.org/Utah, you can sign up for an appointment. We'll come out, we'll check your smoke alarms for you. So even if you're not sure if they're working or, you know, you just need a few more, you can give us a call, you can set up that appointment, or you can go to the website and set up that appointment. We'll come out, we'll check your smoke alarms, we'll check the batteries, we'll install 3 free ones. We actually don't just hand them out. We know when we hand those out, they just end up sitting in a garage somewhere. So we try to make sure those get installed. And then we'll go over a home fire escape plan with you. We'll talk about home fire safety, some basic tips, how to avoid kind of the major causes of home fires and things like that.
Yeah, you know, we've talked a bit about prevention. As someone who has actually started a kitchen fire in high school, it really, in that moment when it starts, you know, you think you know how to work a fire extinguisher, and then when you're in that moment of panic, kind of everything, you know, your mind goes blank. And, you know, what tips, or are there certain online courses or areas where people can go just to learn about responding to a fire, you know, even if that's as simple as how to operate a fire extinguisher?
Yeah, we actually have tips on that website, just to look at and think about kind of different ways to be prepared in the situation. That is home fire education that we also provide. You can also look at the National Fire, the National Fire Protection Association. They have some information there that you can also get to help you be prepared in those situations.
Yeah, and, you know, going back to the history of this week, could you talk just a bit more about that great Chicago fire and why it was kind of commemorated or, you know, felt the need to be recognized in this week of prevention?
Yeah, it's, I think, you know, in terms of history in the United States, it's it caused a devastating amount of loss of life and property. And it really brought awareness to the need of being prepared for a home fire, just because of the unnecessary loss of life due to lack of preparedness and a lack of awareness at the time. Over the years, we've gotten a lot better about that as a result of that particular situation and the devastation that that caused. As a result, in 1925, with the presidential proclamation, the whole goal was to raise awareness and to get people educated and get them thinking about that. And that's kind of played into a lot of different aspects of home building as well. Mm-hmm. You look at building codes and how they've improved over the years. We see less and less home fires, but a lot, you know, occurring in terms of just, you know, accidents that happen at home with cooking, as you mentioned, or with candles and so on.
Yeah, and on a side note, just knowing the broad reach of the Red Cross, just curious if you've been in touch with any colleagues in Florida, or just, you know, if you could kind of give our listeners a sense of what position the Red Cross is in when we have this, you know, this massive storm barreling towards Tampa.
Yeah, so right now we have about 2,000 volunteers that are on the ground in responding actually to Hurricane Helene. Of those, about 500 volunteers are on the ground from Milton getting prepared for that. We have another, I believe, 300 that flew out yesterday. Wow. 7 from Utah, actually, that went out to support those efforts. So we have evacuation sites set up, shelters. We're getting prepared for feeding. We had something to the tune of, I believe, 31,000 people that were in shelters last night. And do expect that number to go up. It's just, we're just encouraging people to evacuate, mm-hmm. To be prepared and be safe, because the storm is, it's another historic storm, unfortunately, and we're bracing to see what happens.
Yeah, and those Red Cross employees that are sent there, you know, they're mostly in charge of, you know, like you said, maybe maintaining these centers where people are coming to stay, or are they doing more intense on the ground work? But, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so there's different phases to that. So initially, obviously, we're focused on the sheltering, the evacuation sites, the feeding for people that are in those shelters. But then as the disaster progresses on after, you know, the news stations left and everything else, we're there for months. So we're doing damage assessment for homes. Mm-hmm. We're looking at getting some immediate financial assistance where we can. Everything that we do depends on financial donations. So the generosity of our donors is actually what makes it possible for us to do what we do. So when you look at that, the volunteers are involved in a wide range of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important thing to remind ourselves of, is that 90% of our workforce is volunteer.
Yeah.
So these are people that commit to 2 weeks, no less than 2 weeks. They go out there, they're away from their families, their jobs, their loved ones, and they're out there to support.
Yeah, and dangerous conditions as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, anything else you want to touch on, Jeremiah?
I think if just for the listeners, if you have the availability or if you're interested in volunteering today, you can go to redcross.org to learn more. We are expediting applications right now, trying to get people deployed if they are available. The reality of our situation is such that in the last year, we've had about $21 billion disasters that have occurred in the United States, with a record number of tornadoes. You're seeing devastating hurricanes and so on. So we need volunteers. It's difficult to keep up with the increase in disasters that we're seeing. We also need donations. So if you are able to and you're in a position where you can, just encourage you to go to redcross.org to donate to support the victims of these hurricanes. You can also text Red Cross to 90999 to make a $10 donation today.
Thanks. Thanks for talking to us, Jeremiah. Have a good day.
You too. Appreciate it.
Take care. Been speaking with Jeremiah LaFranca. He's the director of the Utah Greater Salt Lake Chapter of the Red Cross. And just another PSA, as mentioned earlier, you can visit soundthealarm.org/Utah to schedule an appointment for a free smoke alarm and installation. Getting back into some local news. This season, the Wasatch County Health Department is offering walk-in COVID and flu vaccine clinics. Brenda Scobie with the health department says it is hosting two clinics for residents this month.
Clinics on October 17th and 18th from 10 to 3, and they don't need an appointment. They can just come in, walk in. We can check them in here. So we have different options, but we strongly encourage COVID and flu.
Vaccines are covered by most insurance plans and $12 for anyone without insurance. Scobie says it is effective and safe to get both vaccines at the same time.
We definitely say while you're there, get them both. You can separate them, but right now is the height of flu and COVID. We're seeing a lot more COVID cases. So we just say do them both.
The department will also host vaccine clinics at Wasatch School District schools throughout the month. Nursing coordinator Gina Tuttle says if parents haven't already, they can sign their kid up for the flu vaccine clinic.
We have a QR code that was sent out to parents through an email. There's posters, there's sandwich boards around the schools. You can just scan the QR code and sign your child up for a vaccine.
Scobie says while COVID levels are lower than at the height of the pandemic, the county is seeing spikes in the virus. For clinic dates and location information, you can go to kpcw.org. And statewide data show Park City School District students perform better than average in almost all annually measured academic categories. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on the district's report card for the 2023-24 school year.
The Utah State Board of Education recently released 2023-24 school report cards, an online tool allowing communities to see how well their local schools and districts are performing. The overall achievement in Park City is rated commendable because a higher than average percentage of students scored proficient or above in statewide English, math, and science assessments. The district received the highest rating of exemplary in the growth indicator. The indicator measures the percentage of students who closed achievement gaps in key subjects or demonstrated academic improvement over time. The district also did well in preparing students for post-secondary school. A higher than average percentage of high school students received an 18 or higher on the ACT. They also graduated within 4 years and received a C grade or better in college level classes. Despite preparing for college, only 35% of students, the same as the state average, enroll in universities, colleges, or trade and vocational schools. Still, that's an increase from the 2022-23 school year, when only 30% of district students enrolled in post-secondary institutions. The district also improved early literacy levels during the 2023-24 school year. Over 65% of K-8 students read on grade level, a 5% increase from the previous year. That's also 17% more students reading on grade level compared to the state average. The district struggled most in the English Learner Progress Indicator. The indicator measures the percentage of students at a single school who made adequate progress toward English fluency or proficiency. Grades K through 8 received the typical rating, while grades 9 through 12 received a developing rating. However, the district averages remain higher than state averages. An average of 46% of K-8 students and 54% of high school age students made adequate progress in English. An average of 26% of all district students also reached English proficiency, according to the data. Jeremy Ranch Elementary School struggled the most with English learner progress. It received the lowest score of critical needs in the indicator, as only 20% of students made adequate progress in English. That's 17% below the state average and 26% below the district average. Only 8% of Jeremy's students reached English proficiency during the last school year. A link to the district's full report card is available at kpcw.org. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In studio with me now, I've got Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Parker. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Is my microphone on?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. The City Council, Park City Council meets tomorrow. First item on the agenda, the City Council, you know, normally gets an annual update from the Park City Senior Center. I think the theme, as many listeners have been aware of, is they've experienced some pretty significant membership growth. I did the math based on their presentation. Their members have gone up over 50% in 2 years, from around 384 to 605. You know, where is the city at with that, the RFP for the senior center property in terms of looking to the future there?
So to your point, we have a request for proposals out in the street to contemplate a sort of a mixed, I don't want to call it a mixed use development because we're not contemplating commercial, but the potential to create a partnership or some type of a joint venture with a private developer, seniors, and an affordable housing development all on that particular piece of land that the city has picked up through different parcels over time. So we are evaluating those proposals, and my hope would be, you know, this is sort of the early stages of a potential partnership. There's clearly a lot of ground to plow in terms of what's the intensity of uses that could be offered on that land? What type of uses, how big a senior center could be, how many units of housing we might achieve, and then what the cost would be to the community or the municipality and otherwise. I think we're very fortunate thus far to have this sort of burgeoning senior center that's growing, and the partnership that we have with Summit County. So the seniors currently sort of manage or own their facility. It's on a municipal piece of land in the heart of town, and the Summit County is arguably the operator. They're staffing most of the facility on a day-to-day basis. So it really is a partnership between these three entities. And dare I say, we're contemplating furthering that partnership over time, but we have a long way to go. A lot of considerations.
And if you're at Woodside looking at the senior center, is that land to the left of the building, is that owned by the city and in play?
It is, and the land up and back. And I think the proposal that we put out sought innovative, best ideas, creative solutions, and really contemplated the entire scope of the land there that the municipality owns. And so I obviously can't share the types of proposals we got yet, but we've asked people to contemplate all of it and be creative and use the land to further the goals of this partnership and the community's affordable housing goals.
Yeah. Well, moving on, the council is set to appoint some members to this new nonprofit services committee. I guess for background, Matt, could you kind of explain why the city moved to create this committee?
Sure. So the municipality, more or less on an annual basis, collaborates with service providers and nonprofits in our community that provide services the municipality doesn't have expertise in. We don't have the labor. We don't have the professionals or otherwise. So by way of an example would be offering a food services or a food pantry in our community. That's not a service that the municipality provides. And so there are numerous nonprofits and service providers that provide things that the municipality shouldn't, can't, or isn't at the moment. And we've been doing this for decades. And there's a statute that says how much we can allocate towards these types of services, and we follow that statute closely. And for years, it had been an awarding system. We receive proposals, we make the awards, the council deliberates in a public session to provide the adequate levels of transparency and process. But over the last couple of years, council sought some additional transparency, and I would argue community inclusion in these decisions. And so they have formed an actual board of community members with different types of expertise, and they will make the recommendation after they've reviewed and scored the applications about where these resources should go and what types of services should be provided. Now, the mayor and council will have the final say. Mm-hmm. So this took a lot of work, and I really want to congratulate the staff involved. For this new committee, we received over 60 applications. Yeah, typically, when we have a board or commission open, we receive 6 to 12 applications. So to get over 60, we conducted over 30 interviews, and now we have, I think we did 30 interviews over a 3-week period, sort of an unparalleled level of interest, but I think it speaks volumes to the importance of these services. Many of them are offered to those on our front line or underserved, or they're sort of these critical elements of our community that we rely upon, whether it's recreation, open space, recycling. And so they're things that are dear to people's heart, and I believe that's why we had so much interest.
Yeah, and certainly interesting to see that number of applicants. There was some debate over whether to allow current or existing nonprofit employees on that board, and even with that restriction, still seeing some healthy applicants. Moving on, the council is looking to adopt a resolution that honors Miles Radiman from Park City. You know, can you kind of speak to Miles' significance when it comes to the, you know, the history of Park City Municipal and the role he's played in the city?
Sure, I can see him smiling right now. He's probably listening. You know, I was thinking about this on the way in this morning. You know, Miles is an iconic fixture in Park City. He's been a land use professional. He's been a planner. He's a historic preservationist. He's an open space activist. But at its heart, he's been someone that sort of cared more about community and connections and people than he did himself. He's someone who always ensured that the organization Park City Municipal, sort of the governance, the self-governing structure of this place, was transparent and inclusive, that we remain connected with our business districts, with our residents, with our visitors, and he always sought to ensure that we weren't pitting different aspects of the community against each other. By way of an example, it's not us versus the resorts or open space versus housing. Mm-hmm. Miles always was trying to knit together this tapestry and this fabric of community and connection, maintaining the utmost levels of civility. And to me, the capstone of that is really the leadership program. You know, over 30, 35 years, 40 individuals, work together to commune, and they create this special bond. They move on to wonderful things. Some people stay here, some people leave. They run nonprofits, they run mm-hmm. small businesses. They're second homeowners. Some of them live in Wasatch County, Salt Lake County. Some of them just work here, some of them only visit here. And none of that mattered. What mattered was the connection and the care about this place, being a custodian of it and steward. So Miles has been a mentor to me. He's been a mentor to thousands of professional staff members of the organization. And we love him dearly, but it's time for him to move on. He has an opportunity to retire with his wife and his family. We wish him nothing but the best. I don't think we've seen the end of him. I think we'll continue to see him participate. By the by, We kicked off a new leadership class on Sunday and Monday. So Scott Van Hartsfeldt is leading that class. And we graduated Miles' last class on Friday night. So it was a great way to sort of crescendo things on the way out. Nothing but love for Miles and the work he's done for this community. I couldn't do it justice in a one-minute ditty, but I did think a lot about it on my way in. So thank you.
Wish him the best. And just for perspective, I mean, how many cities in Utah are other cities of Park City size have a leadership program?
I think actually, you know, a fair amount, and they're run very differently, though. I think most of them are either run through a chamber or tourism board, or it's just a 501c3 standalone nonprofit. I think the fact that our program has sort of remained primarily with the municipality, but it's really a partnership. We receive funding from Summit County, from the resorts, from the chamber, and many of the lodging associations and the boards and commissions around town. But we also receive donations from a vast array of alumni that continue to support sort of the next generation. They're paying it forward. So it's really, it's a community-based program. Now, the municipality does a lot to support it, and Paige Galvin is currently sort of the administrative arm of that because we care about it, and we believe it makes us healthier. It makes us stronger. It keeps us level-headed. It makes us walk the walk. It's a really important program for the spirit of this community.
Yeah. Moving on, there is a communications report in the agenda for Thursday's meeting showing some of the tax revenue from July marked the highest ever recorded sales tax revenue in the month of July, and then also the lodging tax saw a pretty significant increase. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, I think I hope that it's a relatively positive outlook moving forward. It's the first month of our new fiscal year. Mm-hmm. And so it's great news to be up almost $300,000 year over year from the previous July. That July is I call it a relatively low month overall in terms of the yield of sales and pillow taxes, or the transient room tax, as you alluded to. So I don't want to... you know, I don't want to get our hopes up too much, but it's a very favorable outlook. I believe we had a strong summer. A lot of work goes into this, though, dare I say. You know, the volume of sanitation, recycling services, street sweeping, street cleaning, transit services, law enforcement that go into a successful month of July. I want to thank everyone involved.
Yeah, and then next up, the city council requested a discussion about zero emissions buildings. I think we're all aware that Park City has set a community-wide goal of 2030 of net zero emissions. What should this discussion touch on?
Well, I think to be fair, in June, when we were evaluating a new city park building, we have what's called sort of the summer camp building in City Park, and we're going to be renovating that and redeveloping that building. We had a discussion with council where they asked us to return to sort of begin to contemplate an overall update of our sustainability policies in this area in particular. So it's, I think the last time we took a look at this policy was almost 2017 was the last time we made a comprehensive update, and really has to do with the way we're approaching the efficiency of our buildings, the potential electrification that we've been undergoing with our fleet and our facilities, use of renewables and regenerative energy sources, and consumption, trying to reduce our consumptive elements in our facilities and our operations. So we haven't taken a comprehensive look at this in 2017, this community building. We want to make sure we're using innovative solutions, the latest and greatest in technology, and we haven't done this in, gosh, almost 8 or 9 years, so it's time.
Yeah, and finally, I wanted to touch on this application on 37 Hillside Avenue. It's a historic structure. It appears the existing owner is seeking to, I assume, demolish it to build something new. Can you talk about how this is kind of reviewed and what are the important variables here as the council reviews this?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I do think at some point you may want to speak out a little bit more in depth with our planning director and the work that our planning department does with regard to historic preservation overall, far more knowledgeable than I am. But, you know, currently there's over 400 sites that are designated landmark or significant on what's called the Park City Historic Sites Inventory. So this town has decades of experience preserving its historic assets. And I would say in a way that's sort of unparalleled. And what really is a distinguishing factor that sets Park City apart. Just the other day, I was at a historic Park City Alliance meeting. We had a business owner talk about having a family friend in town who'd visited ski resorts all over the country. And when they came to Park City's Main Street, it was like this aha moment in Old Town and its distinctive factor. And something she hadn't felt before in another ski town. So we have spent tens of thousands of dollars and hundreds of thousands of hours preserving many of these assets. But that's not to say that private property owners don't have their own opinions about their property and its future disposition and uses. And we have a public process for obviously redevelopment, renovation, and how someone may or may not contest these historic findings or designations of their property. And that's what's occurring here up on Hillside Avenue. We have a homeowner, I believe, relatively recently purchased that's contesting the validity of these historic designations. And they're currently in the process. I think they went before the Historic Preservation Board first. And actually, the Historic Preservation Board didn't agree with the property owner that it could be delisted. And the next step in the process is to appeal that recommendation to the City Council. If City Council can either concur, they can remand, they can ask for some reconsideration, or they can side with the Historic Preservation Board. And unfortunately, the next step would be District Court.
Gotcha. Well, that'll be interesting to see how that turns out. Anything else you want to mention on Thursday's agenda?
Not for Thursday. I do have one additional announcement, if that's okay.
The bus wraps?
Yeah, you got it. You beat me to it. You do it. You'll do it better than I can. How about that? But thank you for the interview. I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, I believe the city is doing a bus wrap unveiling 10 a.m. at Bob Wells Plaza out in front here on Monday.
That's correct. It's a great place for a small community event like that with a bunch of locals. We did a lot of work trying to kind of redevelop the brand of our transit system. We worked hard with the Chamber of Commerce. We received a lot of public engagement and public input. I think we're really proud of it. The buses are going to look fantastic. So encourage people to come out. I believe we'll have some cider and donuts and things like that, but the Bob Wells Plaza is a great place to do a little locals event on Monday.
Yeah, should be good. All right. Well, thanks, Matt, for coming in.
Thanks
for
having me, Parker. I appreciate it.
Yeah. In an effort to protect seasonal wildlife activity, the new Bonanza Loop Trail in Bonanza Flat will be closed until spring 2025. The Mountain Trails Foundation's Laura Anthony reports the trail closed October 1st, but there are plenty of other hiking and leaf peeping opportunities in the Bonanza Flat area.
Get up and do a hike-only trail called Io Trail. It's up out of the Bloods Lake Trailhead. You could hike into Lackawaxen via Bloods Lake Trail. There's lots of options up there. Just the Bonanza Loop Trail is closed officially for wildlife preservation.
Monday, crews will be installing erosion matting on parts of the Seldom Seen Trail near Jenny's. Trail users are asked to slow down in the area and be mindful of crews as they work. You can find more trail updates at kpcw.org. Wasatch High School's broadcasting students can claim the title of Emmy Award winners following big wins in Arizona. KPCW's Amber Johnson has more on that.
The high school's Sting TV student journalists snagged trophies in two student production awards categories at the annual Rocky Mountain Emmys a few weeks ago. The awards recognize the work of outstanding high school and undergraduate college students while incentivizing them to pursue a career in journalism. Sting TV was honored for both their daily newscast and a Hollywood-themed prom commercial. In addition to the daily news reports, the students cover sporting events, scholarship nights, graduation, concerts, and dances. The programs air in classrooms, Sting TV's website, YouTube channel, or on social media. Proud teacher Corey Lang said few high schools have a daily news show because it's tough to pull together. His students are responsible for everything from scripts to anchoring, as well as audio engineering and directing.
We have game day every day. We don't have a week of practice, and then we have a game night on Friday night where people watch. We're on in front of everybody every single day, and so the pressure's there, but I think you hit expectations that you set.
Hoping to have his students recognized for hard work, on a whim, Lang submitted a few entries to the National Academy of Television Arts and Science competition. Kaylee Lang was one of the eight students who flew to Phoenix to walk the red carpet on awards night. She was shocked when Sting TV won, but said the trophies were far from the only reward.
So when we got to go and see all these different shows, it kind of brought a fresh ideas and motivation to come back and change our program and kind of tweak some things so we can really improve. And it was really cool to kind of see like how we can grow even further.
Talon Levitt said things don't always go as planned. She wanted to mix things up the first time she anchored The Daily Show, so she asked the news team to sing a song from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
And everyone came on, and it was really bad, and then our green screen fell down. And we just sat there, and it got silent, and then the TC wanted didn't change, so we, like, sat there while the green screen was gone, like, and we were just, like, didn't know what to do, and everybody felt, I don't even know what the vision was, but it didn't work. It was really embarrassing.
Wright Thurston also talked about a live interview with the girls' soccer team last year that went a bit sideways. The Spectator dress theme was barbecue dads and soccer moms, and he accidentally told everyone to go make out instead of make it out to the soccer game.
We are a class that everybody sees every day, and so it's something that if something goes wrong, it's not like in pottery or in art, if you mess up, nobody sees all of it, where in here, everyone sees it. And so I think it definitely was rewarding to go and see what other schools have to offer and appreciate like what we've done.
The students said winning an Emmy and the opportunity to see the work of others has set a new target for their program. They don't want to just make a fun little show for the high school, but aspire to be the best there is. Amber Johnson, KBCW News.
In other news, cell phone video showing portions of a Park City road rage incident is going viral. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports both the driver and the cyclist involved have been ticketed.
The driver posted the video he recorded to TikTok and a local Facebook group October 7th. Park City police say the incident happened more than a week earlier on September 28th. Cyclist Gary Peacock, 73, says he was biking up Park Avenue toward Old Town Park City from his home in the Centerville Basin when a Subaru drove dangerously close to him. The 22-year-old driver, Pierce Kempton, denies that. Here's Peacock.
I lost my temper. I didn't go there with the intention of hitting them or doing anything, but just, you know, telling them, hey, you came way close to, too close to me, and I'm upset about it. I'm angry about it. And then his reaction just set me off.
Kempton, a videographer by trade, was on his way to meet a friend at City Park's skate park. Peacock confronted him in the parking lot where Kempton recorded him for roughly 6 minutes. The video shows Peacock opening Kempton's car door, which he says was to prevent the driver from leaving the scene. Peacock then called Park City Police, who later told him he was not allowed to open the door. Kempton told KPCW he thought the situation should have been handled differently.
Tell me, I feel like he could have settled that just by telling me with his words. I don't think he needed to be aggressive, and I don't think he needed to get the law involved.
Peacock says the police also told him he didn't have the authority to detain Kempton, and he should have just reported the license plate number. The cyclist adds he routinely has close calls on the road, but that he's never confronted someone.
And this guy, unfortunately, was the subject of my wrath because of all these other incidents.
Kempton showed his cell phone video to the responding officer, who wrote both the cyclist and driver tickets. Court records indicate Peacock received a disorderly conduct infraction and paid $160. Kempton received an infraction for passing too closely, which carries a $130 fine. He says he slowed down and gave Peacock at least the required 3-foot berth, so he's fighting the ticket in court in November. Dashboard camera footage shows Kempton did move left while passing and was decelerating from 29 miles an hour to 26 before reaching Peacock. Kempton passed him at the narrowest part of Park Avenue, where the curbs pinch in and the southbound bike lane disappears, just past the Park City Library bus stop. You can see the video at kpcw.org. Utah law prohibits vehicles from endangering, quote, vulnerable road users, which includes both cyclists and skateboarders. Cars and trucks have to give those users a 3-foot berth when passing. Auto cyclist accidents or near misses are recurring issues in the wider Park City area. Park City police fielded a call about a near miss at Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive 2 days prior to Peacock and Kempton's altercation. And a cyclist was injured in a hit and run on State Route 32 earlier in the summer. Recent road rage incidents between cars have been more severe. A man was shot and killed at Jordan L. State Park late September 25th in what Wasatch County investigators say started as road rage. They are still searching for the suspect who may be driving a Jeep Gladiator or Gladiator Rubicon with front-end damage. Two people were arrested in the Thanes Canyon neighborhood earlier that month after alleged reckless driving on State Route 224. The arresting deputy says one driver brake-checked the other, who then threw coffee at the first car. And in July, a driver was arrested accused of pulling a gun on another driver at the intersection of Interstate 80 and U.S. 40. The 41-year-old Nathan Jacobson Putnam has since been charged with a Class A misdemeanor. Here's Summit County Sheriff Frank Smith on KPCW's Local News Hour.
We've had more road rage incidents in the last 3 months than we have had all year. Take a deep breath. We live in a great place. All those road rage incidents are always followed by regret.
Sergeant Skylar Talbot says the sheriff's office is projecting nearly 10% more attempt to locate calls this year than in 2023. Those are when deputies are asked to find a vehicle on the road. ATLs could be related to a number of issues, but Talbot says, quote, many of them can be attributed to aggressive driving and road rage. Summit County Dispatch received just over 1,900 attempt to locate calls last year. So far this year, it has had almost 1,600. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The human-caused Yellow Lake fire now spans almost 20,000 acres. 10% of the fire is contained. Nikki Champion from the Northern Utah Type 3 Fire Management Team says the storm system has moved into the area, causing a smoke inversion to settle into the surrounding valleys.
It doesn't necessarily mean that there's an increase in fire activity or an increased threat. It often can actually mean the opposite. With the decreased winds and the smoke settling, that is good for fire activity.
Over 500 personnel are working to contain the fire. Crews have finished efforts to prevent the fire from spreading near Mill Hollow Road. They're now working to secure this edge. Fire managers expect to have the fire in this area completely contained soon. The National Forest Service reports the work to secure the blaze in Soapstone also looks promising. The fire has been kept south of Soapstone Road, and there has been minimal growth on that perimeter. However, the southwest corner of the Heart Lake area continues to be difficult for crews to secure. Mandatory evacuation orders for the north and west forks of the Duchesne River remain in effect. Champion reports all structures remain intact. The Granddaddy Lakes area of Ashley National Forest and the town of Hannah in Duchesne County are under a ready order, meaning residents should have bags packed and be ready to leave if any evacuation order is given. Portions of the Uinta Wasatch Cache and Ashley National Forest affected by the fire also remain closed. Highway 35 will remain closed until fire activity decreases and the road can be cleared of debris. Champion says crews are working to open the highway as soon as possible.
The goal is to open that as soon as safely possible, so that could potentially open before the closure is lifted. So folks who utilize that as a main highway or travel way should continue paying attention.
Champion says the Forest Service will host a community meeting at the Duchesne County Centennial Event Center in Duchesne today at 6 p.m. for community members to ask questions and get more information about the fire. Some final news on the way out. General election ballots will be mailed to Summit County voters October 15th. Ballots should arrive in mailboxes the week following, according to Summit County Clerk E. Furse.
People can return those ballots at drop boxes or through the mail.
First says voters planning to return their ballots by mail must be sure they are postmarked by November 4th, the day before Election Day. To receive a mail-in ballot, residents must be registered to vote no later than 5 p.m. on October 25th. Voters can also return their ballots by placing them in any of the 11 drop boxes throughout the county up until 8 p.m. on Election Day, November 5th. Due to construction on a retaining wall along Marsac Avenue in Park City, the ballot drop box historically next to City Hall is being moved to the Park City Library. Early in-person voting is also an option for residents across Summit County. Polling places will be open for early voting between October 31st and November 2nd, as well as on Monday, November 4th. You can find all of this information, ballot drop box locations, how to register to vote, as well as in-person voting locations online at kpcw.org. Once again, ballots are scheduled to go out on October 15th.